Rams playing hardball. Apparently, they did not get the memo that they are being defeated. And a matter of fact, according to the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, they've already lost in a historic setback for them. So one would imagine that we're now just looking for the final stages of some kind of a surrender instrument that we could go on. And in fact, there is a 15-point peace plan, so-called, that's being floated around that they're allegedly coming from the White House. But the Iranian side is not exactly in a surrender type mood, shall we say. We're going to try to break all this down and let you know exactly where things are and what people are saying and what the reality and the truth is on the ground, like we always do. We've got back with us today Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire, the Sunday Wire, and patrickhenningsen.substack.com. Just a really gifted person who's a reporter, Cyril. Patrick, welcome back to the show as always.
It's great to be with you, Daniel.
Well, listen, the Middle East has always been kind of one of your areas of expertise anyway, years before all this. So we're really eager to have you on today to kind of give some historical context, not just commentary on what's being said right now. So we're really grateful for that. But let's look first of all here about kind of where the U.S. is. Now, I'm going to play a Jack Keane first, so I'm just kind of giving people a warning so they don't get PTSD. But he's basically saying that any kind of negotiation, we need to not even worry so much about it because, after all, they are pathological liars.
I'm skeptical here. We're dealing with a regime that's pathological liars and cheaters, and they have done everything they can to deceive us in the past. And just prior to going into this conflict, the Iranians were lying to us and not willing to be forthcoming in terms of a deal. And obviously, we began hostilities. There were other reasons for it, but that was certainly one of them. So we have to look at these people. We know who they are, 47 years here. And President Trump knows exactly who these people are. And I think he knows what he wants out of this. He wants essentially for them to surrender everything that we would take from them by force.
Man, I mean, let's cut right to the chase here. We're looking for a surrender, take whatever we want. I mean, I think they think this is Venezuela part two. What do you say?
It's just gaslighting. It's just gaslighting by Jack Keane. Where and how has Iran ever deceived the United States? I mean, isn't it Iran that signed the Joint Comprehensive Treaty, the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, with the United States, negotiated with the United States in good faith? That was under the Obama administration, 2015, 2016. But then the gaslighting came after that, which is the Trump administration said, it's a terrible deal. This is a terrible deal and so forth. But Trump never in his first term articulated why it was a terrible deal. And this was a landmark agreement guaranteed by European powers, by Russia, by the United States. So the opposite's true. The Trump administration, the U.S., Israel have deceived the world. They've deceived their own electorate by mounting fake, false negotiations and using it as cover for sneak attacks to start an illegal, undeclared war of aggression. So the deception, despite Jack Keane's, bloviating and gaslighting, clearly the U.S. and Israel are the deceivers in this story, not the Iranians.
Patrick, let me ask you a question here, because one of the comments that even preceded this conflict here, especially by those on the conservative side, they said, well, look, yeah, they signed that JCPOA, but they never abided by it. I mean, they were cheating left and right the whole way through. That's why we don't trust them now. What do you know about that?
There's no basis to that claim. That's just a talking point that came. You have to understand how, I don't have to tell you, Daniel, but how Washington works politically is all the politicians, all the media get their briefing sheets and their talking point memos from IPAC or from one of these Israeli lobby organizations. And we saw this a couple of weeks ago, short-term pain for long-term gain. I mean, that was a circulated talking point for all U.S. politicians repeated this, all media outlets repeated it, television anchors were repeating it. So clearly these talking points are prescribed and fit for certain purpose of that time during how operations are going. And that's what they said, was that the Iranians were cheating, but nobody ever gave an example of how they were cheating according to all of the people involved, including the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was completely abiding by the terms of the deal. It was the Americans and the Europeans who cheated. They didn't fulfill their obligations during the JCPOA of lifting sanctions and all of the also the economic stipulations in that treaty. There was also money owed to Iran, which was never paid. So it was the Americans and the Europeans who were not abiding by the terms of the treaty. But Iran, even after the U.S. withdrew unilaterally under Trump's first term, at the express insistence of the Israeli lobby and Netanyahu himself, with via Mike Pompeo, even after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from this deal, Iran was still they still gave it a chance over a year or a couple of years. They were still abiding by the terms of the deal in the hopes that they'd be able to come back into it, or the next administration, the Biden administration, might see sense and want to resume this deal. So it's just lies left, right, and center coming from Republicans, coming from the U.S. media and politicians, because if everyone tells the lie at the same time and you have this chorus, this wall of propaganda in the U.S., then suddenly it becomes fact. Suddenly it becomes reality. And that's just how politics works.
Yeah, we certainly have seen a lot of examples of that. Here's an interesting thing, though. So that's Jack Keane, who is basically saying, yeah, I don't trust these guys, so let's don't have a 15-point peace plan anyway. We'll talk more about some of the details of that in a second. But there's another party to this, shall we say, that's also doesn't seem to be very interested in, and that is the Iranians themselves. Here is the, I think he's the IRGC spokesman, Ibrahim Zulfagari, who's Lieutenant Colonel, spokesman for the Iran military, rejects the idea of a 15 or 14 point plan. Our position, he writes, has not changed from day one, and we will not change. We will never reach an agreement with people like you. Not now, not ever. What you call strategic power has become strategic failure. Now, that doesn't sound like somebody who's on the verge of defeat and is ready to start surrendering. Is that just a misplaced braggadocio, or does he know something we don't know?
Well, I think he's reflecting the reality of this. And, you know, if anybody in the Trump administration has read Clausewitz, they will know that in war is just an extension of politics by other means, which automatically begs the question, what is the political objective of the United States in this? What is Trump's political objective? Is it total subjugation and total surrender and subjugation of a nation state in the current international system? That is not a political end state. It's just not. And it's been proven to be completely null and void. Too many other examples of this. We can go through all of the different U.S. Interventions and nation building projects, but they haven't even articulated anything other than Iran must be dismantled militarily. They must be dismantled in terms of their energy and basically open to potential future attacks. I mean, it's a non-starter for any country that wants to retain their sovereignty. So that's the first thing. So if you think about that, what they thought the political end state in America, they were playing with this idea of regime change, if you remember, at the beginning when this conflict started. And then that sort of fell by the wayside. And then it became a security imperative because Iran, it was an imminent nuclear threat. Well, we know from whistleblowers like Joe Kent and others that, of course, that wasn't even the intelligence assessment of the United States IC. There was no imminent nuclear threat. Those were just lies. So we're really trying to home in on something here that's tangible with the Trump administration. It looks like what the U.S. is doing is acting as a proxy of Israel, because Israel's very clear on their doctrine that Israel will not tolerate if they suspect that any country in the region is a potential rival, or it will challenge Israel potentially in the future, either economically, politically, or militarily, then that threat must be eliminated. That is the Israeli doctrine. And so if that's how the U.S. is looking at Iran through the Israeli doctrine lens, then this makes perfect sense. So then the U.S. is really executing Israel's security diktats in this case, and not, it has nothing to do with American interests, because there's 110 different ways the U.S. could benefit from this situation by de-escalating and by working with Iran as well as their allies in the region. So but from an Israeli point of view, their doctrines makes perfect sense.
Well, now that could be a problem. Let me show you something here. It was just posted on X from Mario Nafal, who's very well connected to the Middle East. He's puts this breaking information here. The Mossad chief Barnea is apparently reporting through Jerusalem Post, so in the open press, that a regime change likely to take, I don't know, about a year. President Trump is looking to try to get out of this deal right now. I don't know militarily how we can go another year. There are plenty of reports out this morning that says one of the more optimistic scenarios I've seen is that we may have enough PAC-3 interceptors and several other things to go at current rates, maybe another couple of months. THAADs are nearly depleted already, THAAD interceptors, and that's it. And then there's no more in the pipeline. Then we have to go to like PAC-2s or some other older stuff that has even less capability. What if we're doing what you just suggested, that we're basically following the Israeli policies, how do you square that we might not be able to go more than a couple of months, and they think that it won't take, at current rates, about a year? How do you square that circle?
I mean, what's their definition of regime change? What, killing every member of parliament in Iran? And that's what Israel has vowed to do. Their defense, Israel Katz, the defense minister, the defense chief of Israel, made that threat last week. He says, we're going to hunt down all Iranian officials, which they're all regarded in our eyes as terrorists. So we're going to hunt them down one by one. And if you look at how Israel has done this with all of their so-called enemies and rivals in the region, their policy with the Palestinians is to assassinate the leadership, and then when the next one comes up, they assassinate them, and then they turn to the world and to us in the West saying, we want to negotiate with the Palestinians, but we don't have anybody to talk to. And Donald Trump repeated this exact same mantra the other day at a White House press opportunity, where he said, there's no leadership left, we've won, and there's nobody left to talk to, quite frankly. We've killed them all. You know, that's basically Netanyahu talking. And this is so the U.S. has adopted this very brutal, very sort of medieval, savage Israeli approach to diplomacy, which is to kill everybody on the opposite side of the table and then claim that you have nobody left to talk to. That's kind of what, where the U.S. is heading with this. So I wouldn't put any currency on anything said by the administration in Washington, because I'm just listening to Israel. And until I see a clear break between what Israel is saying and what the Trump administration is doing, saying and doing, then at this point, I have to assume that it's everything said by this president is disingenuous and being used to buy time to reposition troops, to rearm shortfalls in munitions, and as you said, Daniel, essential interceptors and all these other things. They're just buying time. There's no indication that they're genuinely interested in peace or de-escalation at all. What they're doing is just playing chess and buying time, I think, to rearm. So from that point of view, the Iranians are digging in for a long war. I mean, this could be years.
We have some breaking news on the screen right now. Gary just found it. Looks like that now we haven't validated this. This is literally just breaking. But they're claiming that the IRGC has hit an F/A-18 that crashed into the Indian Ocean. And they have some video here. They claim these days with the deep fakes being what they are, I mean, it could look as real. I don't know, but it looks real here. But something we're going to continue to track down and see if we can get independent verification. But that is something that's going on right now. Toward the end, that you said you can't trust anything out of the White House, and you were talking about diplomacy, but it looks like a lot of things are getting ready to go on the ground. There was an odd juxtaposition between combat and diplomacy yesterday in the White House, where President Trump was making some remarks, but brought along with him was the Secretary of War, who had this gem to say about how he loves to be part of diplomacy.
We see ourselves as part of this negotiation as well. We negotiate with bombs. You have a choice as we loiter over the top of Tehran, as the president talked about your future. President has made it clear that you will not have a nuclear weapon. The War Department agrees. Our job is to ensure that. And so we're keeping our hand on that throttle as long as it's hard as is necessary to ensure the interests of the United States of America are achieved on that battlefield. This is not Iraq and Afghanistan. This is not a president who's interested in vague end states. He's been very clear with us about what we need to accomplish, creating the conditions for them never to have a nuclear capability. And that's exactly what we're doing in historic fashion.
Now, the timing couldn't have been any worse for that, by talking about how we're just hovering over, loitering over Iran, as we have image allegedly that one of those loitering aircraft was just hit and knocked out of the sky. Well, again, we're going to follow on that. But let's put the substance of what he said, that, yes, we want to negotiate with bombs. Can you tell me, with all of your experience, and you've been literally traveled all over the world in a lot of combat zones, have you ever seen negotiating with bombs as a successful tactic for the aggressor nation?
No, I have, but it was before I was born, Daniel. It was Henry Kissinger and Lyndon Baines Johnson thought that they could negotiate and subdue the resistance in Laos and carpet bomb Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam in Operation Rolling Thunder. And that ended in an absolute disaster for LBJ. That was the end of his, that was the funeral of his political career, a horrible, dishonorable swan song to his legacy. And that triggered the end of the beginnings of the end, the rolling back of the Vietnam War. So that's a good American example of wanting to, you know, use this tactic of bombing somebody into submission and somehow breaking their will. What it did was the opposite. The North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, they doubled down, they retrenched, and they ended up effectively winning that conflict. So Pete Hegseth is a revanchist. He is drawing on old, you know, he's wanting to turn the clock back 50 or 60 years, you know, or, you know, think he thinks it's Dresden all over again, you know, but the world moved past that. So, I mean, this is the hubris, this is the sort of corruption, this is what happens when you put somebody into a position of power that they're not qualified to be in the first place. This is the type of result you get, this type of bluster. But it's the fraud, and he's a liar, Pete Hegseth, because he's basing this on Iran can't be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. Let me repeat, the United States intelligence community has presented zero evidence that Iran was developing a nuclear weapon, not once, not twice, but in the last 20 years, three or four times, including in the last year itself. So Pete Hegseth is a liar, and he's using his platform there to push propaganda to justify what is effectively an unconstitutional and undeclared illegal war of aggression by domestic and international law. He doesn't have a leg to stand on. Pete Hegseth is a war criminal standing right there, making threats. I mean, just his statements of intent will basically be gold for any prosecution in a war crimes trial against him.
Yeah, and he said a lot of things.
Very reckless.
Yeah, he said a lot of things over the course of this war that it's going to
be. It is Iraq. He's saying this isn't Iraq. No. This is Iraq. This is exactly.
I would argue that in a pretty critical way, it's not Iraq, and definitely not in our favor that it's different. And let me show you that in just a second. But one of the things he mentioned in there, which I think you've referred to a little bit, he said, he did. He said, we will stay as long as it takes. Netanyahu's Mossad guy saying this could take a year to get regime change, which means it'll be expensive, but it won't be the 3 days we were kind of hoping for, or the one day maybe. But now that we have this from the Royal United Services Institute, this is a British think tank. They're reporting today, you see this just came out, yesterday, 11,000 munitions in 16 days of Iran war. The command of the reload governs endurance. And this really shocking response here that it talks about, it says, if the war in Ukraine was a wake-up call for Western defense industrial base, no one ever answered the alarm, apparently. The first 16 of the Iran conflict are a fire alarm signaling a crisis of endurance. The intense consumption of advanced munitions during Operation Epic Fury has revealed a critical vulnerability, a strategically ruinous cost exchange ratio that the West industrial capacity is not prepared to sustain. Now, this is not a shock. I think you and I have even talked about this sometimes here, but it seems to have been at the highest level. That means the Secretary of War. That means the President of the United States. That means the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I don't know if they literally gambled everything on saying, no, I think this will work with the decapitation strike on day one and we'll win the war. We don't have to worry about a long war. I don't know. But now then we see that we don't have the capacity to wage this long war, whether it's a month, 2 months, or anything beyond that. What does that mean to you?
Well, firstly, just quickly, the Iraq war comparison to Iran is both wars were predicated and relied on a fake WMD claim in order to justify the war. The same with Iraq, it was chemical weapons, and in this case, it's a fake WMD claim about nuclear weapons. It's just that the Bush administration, the neocons, actually put the effort in to fake the intelligence, whereas Trump and Hegseth don't need to bother putting on a show for the U.S. They just kind of stand up there and say it, and therefore it is true. But back on that front, Daniel, I mean, you talk about the military timeline and the fact that the U.S., you know, cannot wage a war of endurance or a war of attrition against the Iranians. There's a lot of problems. One is they're out of area. That's the most obvious. Two, their regional capabilities and facilities have been severely degraded by the Iranians already in the first couple of weeks. So that really leaves naval assets as the sort of main support, as well as trucking things in from Europe or long-range bomber flights from Europe, so relying on Germany and the UK, et cetera. But that's just a technical military timeline. There's another timeline that the United States have a massive problem with, which is the political timeline. They're running on an extremely short political timeline. The Trump administration, plus, you know, the economic situation. But aside from the fact, Daniel, this is bankrupting the United States. And between Ukraine and now this farrago here, in Iran, it's going to bankrupt the U.S. They're just going to pay for it through deficit spending. That means inflation at home, but you have additional inflationary pressures with the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and the constriction of the oil supply. So there's an additional pressure on that political timeline for the U.S., for the Trump administration, for the Republican Party. Okay, plus there's that military timeline as well, which you've just laid out some important points of. But here, how about Iran's timeline? How does that look? Is that as short as Trump's to either pull results? Israel's timeline is extremely short. The fuse is short on the Israeli political viability of Netanyahu in this current situation, even despite all the censorship. So this very much reflects, Daniel, the same relationship with the proxy war against Russia and Ukraine. Russia is playing a long game. They dug in. They have the strategic depth. They have the ability domestically to produce. They have their own military industrial complex. So they're patient. They're working on a much longer timeline. NATO, Europe, the U.S. in Ukraine, and in Ukraine itself, extremely short and volatile timeline. They need to deliver results constantly to keep the people, the press engaged, to keep the various political actors engaged and supporting this proxy war in Ukraine. It's really going to become the same thing here. So the only options for Trump is to double down, to escalate, to bring the troops in. I think the bringing the troops in, the introduction of U.S. forces to, you know, for instance, if they wanted trying to take Karg Island, this is a cynical move by the Trump administration that's willing to throw U.S. lives of U.S. soldiers as cannon fodder in order to rile up the Patriot base in America to back more escalation in this war. That's what I think, because if it's about you know, keeping our troops out of needless wars, all the things that Trump's allegedly campaigned on, that J.D. Vance also campaigned on as well, if it's about that, then they've just basically canceled any real genuine belief in that area. And now you can see they're willing to throw. Israel would love, what do you think Israeli planners are thinking if there were 400 or 1,000 dead U.S. servicemen trying to retake Karg Island? Do you think central planning in Tel Aviv, do you think that they would look at that as a positive, that they can leverage that? I think they would like that. And I think they would use that to the max to pull the U.S. further into the conflict, because Israel cannot achieve its goals and objectives without the United States. And that is actually the bottom line of this entire story.
But so that brings up a number of problematic points. I mean, forget about talking about what's wise or foolish for the moment, but let's talk about what is even possible. And one would imagine, anyway, that behind the scenes, that in the Pentagon or in the Situation Room in the White House, that they at least know, they have a spreadsheet, so they at least know the fundamentals here. And one of the fundamentals that was actually revealed by our ally, UK, the former MI6 chief, went on a broadcast today and admitted something that I think is going to take a lot of people by surprise. And he said, basically, we don't have the upper hand. That belongs to Tehran.
But the reality is the U.S. underestimated the task and, I think, as of about 2 weeks ago, lost the initiative to Iran. In practice, the Iranian regime has been more resilient than I think anyone would have expected. They took some good decisions, actually, as early as last June about dispersing their military capability and delegating the authority for the use of those weapons, which has given them significant extra resilience against this incredibly powerful air campaign. They have embarked on what's technically called horizontal escalation, i.e. firing rockets at anybody within range, which at the time, honestly, Shawshank, I thought was nuts, but in fact has been a very good way of putting in direct price on the U.S. sort of work.
That's good enough right there, Gary. So the bottom line is, now here's even an MI6 chief, and he's not in government, former MI6 chief, but obviously UK is one of our staunchest allies, and they're not going to be saying stuff out loud, especially at that level, unless it has been coordinated with the government. So the fact that he's saying this stuff now, which is completely contradicting what you just heard Secretary of War there, Pete Hegseth, say from last night, that, man, we got this thing basically won already, and we're going to diplomatic our way to victory with bombs, etc. There is a real problem here. And do you think that message is going to be getting through to anybody here, or are we going to keep plunging down into escalating this situation? And by that, I mean expanding and deepening our real strategic vulnerabilities by trying anything on the ground.
Well, I can tell you there's a number of high profile British military figures, officers, retired as well, but still a very high rank and well-respected, as well as British politicians, some that are currently out of government, even on the conservative side. Rory Stewart, for instance, basically echoed the exact same thing in that clip that you just played there. So these are the consensus makers in terms of British politics. So clearly there's a break and a change in thinking there on the British side. How that's going to translate into policy with a very supine Keir Starmer government that seems to be lost in the dark on a lot of this and just is basically defaults to a subservient position with Donald Trump on pretty much everything. We'll see how this translates there. But the other part of this is that he's right in that clip, but he's right about the fact that, they underestimated the Iranians' resilience and their ability to survive. They overestimated how easy regime change would be and all of these things. And he said nobody could have foreseen that. Did you hear that? Nobody could have foreseen that. So he's the head of intelligence.
Right.
So he's talking about everybody on your show, Daniel, all of our guests and on Judge Knapp's show and on Nima's show have been saying this before the war, that you shouldn't underestimate, because Iran society is not going to break up. You're not going to get regime change if you assassinate the supreme leader. And the protests that were fomented in December and January are going to have the opposite effect. And I saw that for myself on the ground in Tehran weeks after. So if we know that and they don't, if he's genuine, then those people are informing and advising our political leaders, and they don't know what they're talking about, or they have no real good on the ground or understanding or appreciation for the Iranian political economy and the political system there. That to me is quite shocking and disturbing. So that's one thing I'll say, but if this was a conventional war, like Iraq was effectively a U.S. powerful conventional military operation against Iraq, a conventional military, and the U.S. has overwhelming force, and the balance of force and resources are overwhelmingly in favor of the United States. But that's not the war we're fighting here. This is totally different. Iran is fighting a completely unconventional, by traditional conventional standards, they're fighting a completely different asymmetric type of war. So how do you measure success? Pete Hegseth thinks you're going to measure it by how many missile launchers you've taken out, how many F-14 Tomcats, you know, 1972 fighter jets that Iran had on the tarmac, and how many whatever naval boats. And Donald Trump is boasting about the statistics and all of that. But that's not necessarily going to translate into automatic victory by sheer nature of the fact that Iran is now at their 70th missile barrage waves, 70 missile barrage waves, and they're still sending them. They might claim that they're not sending as many, but they're still coming. And that's not to say that we have seen the totality of Iran's military capabilities yet, because we haven't. Likewise, the United States has not shown all of its military capabilities for the damage it can inflict on the Iranians. So on both sides, it is still a chess match there, but you can't measure this by traditional military metrics in terms of what's a success, what's a victory. They think that they could just degrade and destroy, and that that's somehow going to translate into victory. Back to our original point, Daniel, what's the political end state for degrade and destroy? Does that mean the war is going to end, or are you actually motivating Iran to dig in deeper, and you're increasing solidarity and resilience in Iranian society and through the military ranks? And I might throw one last thing in, Daniel. What do you think recruitment is like right now in the IRGC in Iran? I think they're probably having trouble processing the amount of applications. So if they go to fully mobilize, I don't think Iran's going to have a problem mobilizing another 500,000. I don't think it's going to be a problem for them. Do you think America can mobilize another 100,000 to fight this unpopular illegal war? I doubt it.
Yeah, no, in fact, if you look at the approval ratings, and you look at the polling here, 61% disapprove of this war, as you can see on the bottom part of that call-out box there. So if that's where we are at the less than 4 week mark, probably not going to get a lot of that. But let me show you something. I got some breaking news for you here. This was sent to me by Larry Johnson, who's going to be on our show this afternoon. But he said, I asked him before we're showing this if he was able to validate. He said he has been able to. I'll just caveat this by saying we haven't been able to independently validate this yet. We're going to continue to track this down. But because Larry said that someone has validated this, I'm going to show it to you. This is reportedly the Gerald R. Ford from the rear side here. We claim that it left the battle area because of a fire in the laundry room or something like that burned for a couple of days. And then now here you say there is physical attack damage on the back of the ship, which matches what the IRGC claimed that they did earlier on, that they said that they hit it with a ballistic missile. Now, I can't confirm any of this yet. I think there were some wounded in action that have been reported from the ship. We're going to continue to follow that. But you talk about something that could be a morale boost for the Iranian side. If that is validated, and if that is, I can only imagine it's going to hit the airwaves here pretty soon, and it's going to go all over social media, because that'll be a major, major humiliation for the United States. How do you see it?
Yeah, we saw a similar thing with the military campaign against Yemen, which was waged over the course of a couple of months there. They massive underreporting on U.S. aircraft losses. And there's also some debate and discussion over what caused the loss of some of those aircrafts against Yemen. They say it was an aircraft carrier trying to make a sharp maneuver. Was it making an evasive maneuver to avoid a Yemeni anti-ship missile? Was there any contact? We don't know. There's been no independent survey of the damage there or an investigation into what caused that. We just have to take the word of the Department of Defense at that time, still the Department of Defense. And I think you have the same thing here. The U.S., Donald Trump could not withstand the political fallout from, you know, image of one U.S. ship smoking in the Indian Ocean, or one F-35 crashing into a fireball. I mean, he couldn't withstand the political pressure, because the line that the White House is pushing on the American people is, it's a perfect war, typical Trump. It's a perfect war. This has been perfect. Pete, you've done a great job there. There's nothing left. They don't have a country anymore, says Trump. They don't have any leadership. They're just not even functioning as a country. That's not true. And likewise, if you count up the U.S. losses in drones and aircraft in this conflict, it's only been 4 weeks, Daniel. I believe in any specific conflict or exchange or hostilities, the U.S. has lost more of its air assets, and that's not counting all the military assets that have been damaged or destroyed in the Gulf from Iran missile salvos. So, I mean, record losses for the United States in just 4 weeks. There's nothing to compare it to. I mean, what normally that you'd get fired, wouldn't you, as a Secretary of Defense?
Right. Yeah. And let me just add to that. There's also the official reports is that 13 Americans have been killed so far. 241, I think, was the last official number I've seen of wounded. That number continues to go up there. $200 billion in the supplemental that's going to be requested here, around $2 billion a day we're burning through. I just showed you 11,000 missiles of various kinds have already been gone through. Our inventories just aren't without end, so that's going to be a problem. But let me show you a couple of other problems. Let me shift gears a little bit. That's putting even more pressure on President Trump, not even just on the military front, and that is on the economic front. We have this report out this morning from the Jeff Currie, who's the chief strategy officer at Carlisle Energy. And he said it's going to be a real shortage. We're talking about the biggest supply disruption the world has ever seen. This is the biggest disruption of both 1973 and 1979 combined. The physical market is really going to bite sometime in the next couple of weeks, he said. Now, let me show you why that's important, because here's a snapshot from this morning of the price of oil, and you see a couple of things on there. You see President Trump, the oil was rolling up over $100 a barrel, and then he claimed on Monday morning at 7:23 a.m. that, you know what, forget about this ultimatum that I had. We'll give you five more days on that. That immediately had this huge plunge you see on the left. And then last night after the market that was released anyway, that there was a 15-point plan. So maybe there's actually a chance that we're going to even the five-day extension won't happen. And you see, again, the market immediately reacted to it. But what what's his name? Jeff Currie is saying here that you can talk your way out of some of this stuff for a while, but then the physical market is at some point, because the oil is just not getting out. So at some point you can't talk your way into lower gas prices, lower oil prices, sorry, and it's going to start to have a problem. What are your concerns about how that's going to play out here if we don't do anything to get this over with in the near term?
Well, you've got the realities of the market, and then you've got this kind of opportunism here, and the Financial Times and others reporting that massive bets were placed. So call options put in before Trump's announcement on True Social. I mean, it's not even through official government channels. You have to remember that's a social media platform owned by Donald Trump, owned by the president. That should be a scandal in itself. And then all of a sudden you see all this, oil prices drop and, market cap shoots up on the S&P 500. And then 2 hours later, the Iranians say, no, we're not talking to Trump about any of this. And all of a sudden you see the reversal, oil goes back up again, and then the market crashes. And now, the evidence suggests strongly that Trump insiders would have knowledge of his announcements, have made money on the surge, made money on the dip, and probably made money on the rebound. And this is just an ongoing cycle of opportunism. So they can just do this game and then just make money just intermittently along the process of this. And the United States isn't in a rush, because look, when Trump said, you have 48 hours, otherwise we're going to bomb your power plants, all that was just a cover for another Israeli attack, because Israel went straight in to do it themselves. And then the U.S. can just play a good cop and say, oh, we didn't know what Netanyahu was going to do there. So the whole shtick is getting old. The Iranians aren't falling for it, but the American people are falling for it. The markets are falling for it. That's the difference.
Well, but they're falling for it now. But I mean, what isn't fluctuating is the price of gasoline here that all of these folks are paying. Because while you have big market fluctuations, the gasoline price goes up and it stays up. In fact, when you hit the next spike, it just goes up a little higher, but it doesn't rebound that way. So people are paying higher prices at the pump already. So the question is, and I've got something else to shift over here in just a second, but what are your concerns about how much pressure this is going to put on the Trump if this starts to go beyond, you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 months, et cetera, and that price doesn't come down? In fact, it continues to go up.
No, there's constant inflationary pressure. This is also basically going to put the kibosh on any potential rate cuts. You know, there's this war between the Federal Reserve and the Trump administration about interest rates and Jerome Powell. So, you know, what are you going to do now? Like, open this spigot even more with the Fed? And that's not going to happen. They're already asking, like you said, Daniel, for $200 billion in supplementals after announcing they want to up the military budget by $1 to $1.5 trillion. So, like, what is this going to do? It's just going to create inflation for the American people. We pay that in inflation tax. Americans pay the bill, but who makes the money? The oil and gas sector in the U.S. is profiting from the shortage of supply in the global market, and specifically the disruption of supplies to Europe, Qatari LNG. We talked about this a month ago. And just in the exact same way, the U.S. has taken advantage of the magical sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline to become the number one supplier of premium-priced U.S. fracked LNG to Northern Europe. They certainly have their eyes on upping production for Europe as well. So that's the real paradigm shift here, is U.S. control and dominance over Europe. That's definitely a takeaway. And so that's Trump's base, Daniel. His base is big oil, big gas, Wall Street, the big AI, that and big defense. That's Trump's base. MAGA is disintegrating. His popular base, as you can see from the polling, is disintegrating. So his base is really the plutocracy, the oligarchy here. The polling is very, very clear. It's going in the wrong direction on every single metric in the run-up to the midterms. He'll never recover any of these constituencies again, because most of these people, including independents, everyone I know who voted for Trump, they probably couldn't stand him and have to hold their nose on so many things. But the fact he ran as an anti-war, anti-regime change war candidate, that's how he got the independent votes.
Yeah,
clearly that was a single issue decision for a lot of voters that gave him the edge in multiple swing states in a general election. That's not going to happen anymore. They've gone. I know Republicans that are vote. I'm in a red state right now, Daniel. I'm in Arizona. I've met Republicans that are going to register as Democrats in the primaries to basically try to vote out Republican candidates in the primaries because they're so pissed off that they basically put the kibosh on the War Powers Act vote. That the Republican Party has become so pro-war, and that this administration has become so pro-war, there's people willing to change parties in opposition to this war agenda by the Trump administration.
And we hadn't even gotten the worst of it yet. We're still on the very front side of this, and especially if there is a ground operation coming up, some suggest it could be as soon as this weekend, and we start having a lot of casualties, that could change in a hurry. I only have a few minutes left here, and then I want to cover a couple of other things here. One is, we talked about the domestic pressures, but that's not the only pressures Trump's facing. He's also facing pressure specifically from Iran. Now, this is their IRGC, I think, spokesman Zulfagari, who said, you know, we completely reject the 14-point plan. Our position has not changed from day one, and it will not change. What you call strategic power has become your strategic failure. We also have this from today, that the Iraq apparently is moving closer to entering the war, as they have authorized the Shia PMF, that's military facilities there, sorry, to retaliate, to people that are aligned with Iran, to retaliate after U.S. and Israeli strike kill fighters in Anbar. And then we also have this other one piece of information I want to run up here real quick, is that the Houthis now are maybe considering joining in and blocking, along with Iran, the Bab al-Mandeb down here in the south. so you could have even more problems, not just the Strait of Hormuz, but possibly also the Bab el Mandab. This could get really bad in a hurry if the United States or if the United States does, in fact, take action on the ground, which the Iranians are saying, and even their speaker is saying, we're monitoring your troop deployments very closely in the region. What the generals have broke, the soldiers can't fix. Instead, they will fall victim to Netanyahu's delusions. Do not test our resolve to defend our land. Again, I ask you, is that just, you know, putting on a brave face for something, or do you think they have a plan to defend their country that will work?
Well, let's start with Trump has done something that is incredible. He killed Iraqis in Hegseth. They killed Iraqis this past week. And they like to frame the PMUs, the People's Mobilization Units, the Hashdul Shabi. They love it constantly. It's the Israeli talking point again, which is that these are Iranian proxies. The PMUs are part of the Iraqi, under the Iraqi Ministry of Defense. They are part of the Iraqi military command structure. Those are all Iraqis. And Trump just murdered a whole bunch of them. And he did it the same thing. The NATO mission and U.S. forces negotiated a ceasefire, a so-called ceasefire with the Trump administration to allow exfiltration of those Western forces. And the U.S. used that as cover for a sneak attack and decided they'll kill a bunch of Iraqis on the way out. Because to them, they're Iranian proxies. So they're so-called terrorists in the eyes of Washington. And this is literally, this is straight from Israel, the framing of this. And they're not. They're Iraqis. And guess what? When the PMFs mobilize, and they will do another round of mobilization, Daniel, and their numbers will go from 120,000, which is roughly where they're at now, and they could easily mobilize another 50,000. And Iraq could then change politically in terms of securing their own airspace. And is the U.S. going to fight? They're already fighting a war with Iran. They're going to end up fighting a war with Yemen. Do they want to fight a war with Iraq as well? Again, because this is not the Iraq of 2003. This is a completely different political and social makeup of that country. And also in terms of its orientation with the U.S., the relationship is at an all-time low. And the people in Iraq are very anti-U.S. right now, generally. It's not popular to be pro-U.S. in Iraq. So Trump has just shot himself in the foot. But he did that probably at the orders of Israel. That seemed like an Israeli operation, but done by the U.S. with no thought put into it at all in terms of the political ramifications. Israel doesn't care. They don't care what America's political ramification, what price America's going to pay. They just assume America's going to, you know, take it on the chin and just deal with it. And so this is a perfect example of a potential strategic blunder, because if you're mounting a major potential assault or offensive against Iran, you're going to need the cooperation of Iraq, and they don't have it anymore. So yeah. That really makes their vector is very narrow in terms of the path for attacking Iran. It just got narrower after this week.
Well, yeah, it did, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for right now, because we have Larry Johnson coming back up here in just about 5 minutes from now. We're going to be tuning in on that. But listen, I am very, very grateful for you coming on, Daniel. As always, you really have given us a lot of insight here into things that we otherwise would not have known. And none of the news is good for those who want some peace. But as always, we say we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring people the truth, no matter what it is. Thank you very much, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.
Thank you, Daniel.
Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.